Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today, through the wonders of Skype, is Dr. Alice Koenig, lecturer in Latin and Classical Studies at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. This is Episode LI, Frontinus. Frontinus was a respected senator during the days of Domitian, Nerva, and Trajan. He had a background in the military, and he's the man that wrote the book on Rome's aqueducts. Here's Alice Koenig.
Frontinus ended up becoming one of Rome's most influential senators at the very start of the Nervan and Trajanic era. But he obviously starts his career rather earlier than that. So we're not sure exactly where he came from, but we think he probably came from somewhere in Gaul. He's not native Roman, and his family status was probably equestrian. So he's not coming from a senatorial family. In other words, he's someone who rises higher than his family origins. Mm. But we do know that he was admitted to the Senate at some point, probably in the late 60s, probably actually under Nero. Possibly it was a little bit later under Vespasian. And he went on to have initially a fairly predictable career. So we hear of him in AD 70, for example, serving as Praetor Urbanus. That's a civic administrative post in Rome. And he convened the Senate in that capacity at the start of AD 70 and then relinquished the post to the young Domitian. We know that he probably became consul for the first time around AD 73. And he then had some military service in the Rhineland region sometime in the early 70s under Vespasian, probably. And then references in one of his own texts suggest that he also served under Domitian in some of Domitian's German campaigns against the Chatti in around 83 AD. Particularly interesting for me is that he was governor of Britain from around 74 to 78 AD. And the historian Tacitus tells us about this in his biography, The Agricola. He tells us that Frontinus, under his leadership, the legions in Britain subdued a tribe called the Silures in South Wales that had been causing trouble for the Romans for some 30 years. So as governor of Britain, Frontinus really does make a bit of a difference. And then he came back from Britain and was given the proconsulship of Asia, which is a very, you know, this is the sign that this consul has risen pretty much as high as you might expect him to rise. And that was around AD 84, 85. So over a period of 10 years or so, he has what becomes quite a stellar senatorial career. We don't hear of him much for the next decade or so after 85. So in 97 AD, Frontinus was made Curator Aquarum, that's superintendent of Rome's aqueduct network under Nerva. And he was also chosen by Nerva to serve on a senatorial committee that Nerva had set up to look into financial economies. And both of those posts are posts which put Frontinus in the position of someone who's reacting against the corruption of the previous Domitianic regime.
This is kind of making a few assumptions on my part here, but the Senate was very important around that time by putting Nerva in power initially. Given that he was an important senator and his role in the Senate then and the position that he got given by Nerva, is it safe to assume, can I even assume that he might have had a role to play in putting Nerva in power to begin with?
I think we can assume that he may well have been involved in that. It's even more certain that he was involved then in Nerva's subsequent adoption of Trajan to be the next emperor, because in 98, Frontinus becomes consul for the second time. Now, that's quite significant. Quite a few people who get a second consulship, very few get a third, but Frontinus gets a third consulship in 101. In both 98 and in 101, Trajan is the other consul of the year. There are always two consuls. So Frontinus is selected not just to be consul for the third time, but to be Trajan's colleague as consul. And that suggests that Trajan, at least, and probably Nerva too, were very grateful to him for the role he must have played behind the scenes as a former consul, a very important senator, in putting them both on the throne.
That's good. He sounds like a kingmaker.
Yeah, absolutely. And then Trajan took quite a long time actually to return to Rome. He wasn't back in Rome until about a couple of years later. So Frontinus was one of the small coterie of senators who actually ran the empire from Rome following Nerva's death and while Trajan was still touring and finishing campaigns and coming home. Mm. So you know, he didn't just help make Trajan emperor. He kind of ruled as part of a small elite under Trajan during the early part of his reign.
So you mentioned earlier that Tacitus mentioned him in the Agricola. Where else in Roman writings do we have evidence of him?
Well, yes, Frontinus crops up a couple of times in Tacitus, both in the histories and in the Agricola. And in the Agricola in particular, he's a very interesting character. He's characterised, like Agricola himself, as a great man. And Frontinus comes across almost as a parallel of Agricola somehow, but one who survived beyond the end of Domitian's reign. So he's a very interesting, exemplary figure in that text. But we also hear about Frontinus in the letters of Pliny the Younger, for example. Frontinus was clearly a patron to Pliny. Pliny's grateful to him for putting his own name up to succeed him in the post of augur. And Pliny also talks about a legal committee that he was on with Frontinus, and he characterises him there as one of the most respected men of his era. So Pliny actually ends up exploiting Frontinus's huge status and reputation to bolster his own at times. We also hear about Frontinus in the epigrams of Martial in Book 10. A couple of Martial's epigrams mention Frontinus. There's one in particular where he reminisces about a time when he and Frontinus enjoyed writing poetry together. And that's an epigram in which Martial then bemoans the fact that Rome has dragged them both into the arena of business, and Frontinus is no longer free to write poetry. He's a statesman now, and Martial has to sort of go back to Rome and do the patron-client thing, and it's a terrible imposition on a poet because it stops him writing poetry. That's quite a fascinating glimpse of Frontinus at leisure, and it shows us that Frontinus was someone who was known on the literary scene. He didn't just have a political career, he's someone who's a cultivated man of letters. And indeed, there's a Greek author, Ilionus Tacticus, who wrote a military treatise fairly early on in Trajan's reign, and he also talks about Frontinus's military writing and cites Frontinus as the Roman authority on military matters, partly because of his own military experiences, but he also mentions that Frontinus has done military writing, and he's the only Latin military author whom Aelian identifies. The rest of the ones he talks about are all Greek. Mm. So, yeah, we get this sense that Frontinus has many strings to his bow.
Yeah. He sounds like a man of many talents, and we're going to get more of that as we further discuss this. We do have some of Frontinus's writings. Unfortunately, we've got none of his poetry, do we?
No, there's no trace of any poetry by Frontinus surviving.
Ah, that's a shame. But we do have, we'll start with the fragmentary text that we have first, which was on land surveying, isn't it?
Yes. Four substantial fragments of a treatise on land surveying have been transmitted in various manuscripts under Frontinus's name. Now, it's not clear if they all belong to the same work or if they did quite how they fitted together, but they do give us a really interesting glimpse of Frontinus as both an author and an administrator, and he's talking about a very important Roman institution. And land surveying is the art of measuring out and allocating land, and it's also the process of recording land divisions and adjudicating on boundary disputes. So it's a very important tool of empire. And land surveyors could be both practitioners on the ground and administrators with the authority to settle certain legal cases. And it seems that Frontinus probably did have first-hand experience of land surveying. He may well have had experience of that in a military context. He also probably had some experience of it when he became superintendent of Rome's aqueduct network too.
Yeah.
He clearly wrote a treatise on land surveying. It's one of the earliest texts on Roman land surveying to survive. And there's evidence from the period that there's actually a sort of a new wave of enthusiasm for and interest in the science of land surveying at the time. It's perhaps becoming an increasingly prominent tool in both a military and a civic context, and increasing numbers of the Roman governing elite need to know about it.
So why do you think he wrote about it then? Was it to do with the job that he had, or was it almost an interest?
It could have been a bit of both. My hunch is that it's partly because he had to get involved a bit with land surveying himself in one capacity or another. Mm. And partly because then he does emerge as someone who gets really interested in these kinds of things and thinks, aha, I think we need to know more about this. But his text doesn't simply tell us what we know. It actually helps to create a sense that land surveying is a really complex science. So the treatise has different parts. There's a survey of different types of land you can divide territory into. There's a survey of the different types of land dispute that a surveyor might have to adjudicate in. There's also some reflections on the history and the origins of land surveying. And then there's a more obviously didactic section on how to do certain kinds of measuring. But it's clear that this isn't simply a didactic handbook from one expert to help instruct another. It's a text that really puts land surveying itself on the map and elevates the status of land surveying and the status of those who have an expertise in it. So it's about an important Roman institution, but it's a text that makes that Roman institution seem even more important and even older and more authoritative and more complex. And it reveals Frontinus himself as a very sophisticated writer on what is ostensibly a very practical topic. He manages to show what a brilliant surveyor he is by actually surveying all sorts of material on the page. He categorizes and divides his material with an incredible flair. We see him loving the sort of detailed knowledge of institutions that underpin Rome's imperial power, and that he himself probably had some first-hand experience of. But we also see him really enjoying presenting that detailed knowledge in ways to shape it into a science or an art, raising its status and its significance even higher.
The next work that we're going to discuss is the Stratagemata. And this is a complete work which seems to be a collection of military tactics. Is that fair?
Yes. We have more of a sense of when this probably was written. We're not sure at all when the land surveying treatise was written, although it's a fair guess that it was probably written earlier rather than later in Frontinus's career. But the Stratagemata, we're pretty sure, was written under Domitian in the late 80s or the early 90s. And we think that because it does refer to Domitian four times with some moderate flattery, but there are no references to anyone or anything after the time of Domitian. And you would certainly expect some mention of Trajan or Nerva if it had been written under them. And yes, as you say, it's a compilatory work. It's a collection of examples. Another big example of that is Valerius Maximus's treatise on memorable deeds and sayings. So it collects together lots of anecdotes from all sorts of different times and places, largely Greek and Roman, but not simply Greek and Roman. Lots of anecdotes of successful generalship, how a general managed to conjure up a triumph out of nowhere.
So is that his target audience then?
Well, his target audience, it's ostensibly a didactic work. And in his preface, he says that his aim is to furnish readers with examples that might inspire their own deeds if they're anxious or afraid or unsure what to do themselves. So the premise of the text is that it's written for future generals. He puts a lot of emphasis on how carefully he's organized his material. He's divided it into separate books that deal with before battle, during battle, sieges, and so on. And within the books, he's mapped out everything into all sorts of careful subcategories. So there's sections on how to conceal one's plans, how to find out one's enemy's plans, how to prepare ambushes, and so on. And he talks about the way that he's mapped his material as a general might map a campaign. He deliberately uses that military language to talk about his writing. But he isn't just writing for generals who are a bit anxious about what to do next. It's not simply a practical didactic text. In reality, the audience are mostly sort of armchair generals. Some of them might have had some military experience, some might have some military experience in the future, but many of them won't. And many of them are interested more generally in Roman military activity, in generalship, in leadership. I should also say that this text is presented by Frontinus as a follow-up to an earlier lost treatise that he wrote on the art of warfare. Mm. And that text he talks about briefly at the start of the Stratagemata as a science of warfare. So that presumably was a bit more like his land surveying text, more setting out prescriptions and theories. This secondary supplementary work is designed to illustrate with lots of examples some of the principles presumably that he outlined in his earlier work.
I noticed when I was reading his preface as well that he's very cautious to let the reader know that this isn't extensive, this isn't the final word on things, and there are other works out there as well. It's almost like a disclaimer for his work.
A wonderful modesty with some extraordinary boasting. So he's writing in a very long tradition of Greek and Roman texts on the science of warfare. But you're right, he does say, look, I've trawled through hundreds of histories so that you, the reader, don't have to, and it's all here, but who could possibly be comprehensive? It's not exhausting. And if you do find any examples of your own, feel free to add them in. That's a disclaimer. I also quite enjoy reading it as a challenge too. I think Frontinus is saying, look, I bet you can't find anything. And remember, he's got hundreds of examples all collected together. He has trawled through history. Of course, people might think of another one. But I remember this is directed also ostensibly at people who might be doing deeds themselves. And there's potentially a sense when he says, you know, feel free to add your own, that he's sort of laying down a challenge as well. You know, can you come up with one?
Yeah.
But yes, you're right. There's also this sort of disclaimer that, you know, he hasn't got everything in there. Mm. But it is pretty exhaustive in some ways.
Yeah, it looks it. So you were going to go through a couple of points, weren't you? You wanted to highlight something out of On Concealing One's Plans.
Yeah, I just wanted to give a flavour really of the very start of the treatise. Now, one of the things that's really striking about the Stratagemata, which is different from many other military treatises, in fact, almost all other ancient military treatises, and also other works in the exemplar tradition, is that Frontinus mixes Roman and non-Roman exemplar together. Now, Valerius Maximus, in his collection of memorable deeds and sayings, has Roman examples and then non-Roman examples. And most military treatises particularly peddle a line that there's something distinctively Greek or distinctively Roman about strategy.
Mm.
Frontinus' text does something quite different. So he starts off with Cato the Elder as his first example, writing letters that are going to outwit various towns he's just conquered in Spain. Now, Cato the Elder is one of Rome's foremost, most famous generals, played a huge role in the Punic Wars. He coined that famous phrase, Carthage must be destroyed. You know, he's a big, big figure in Roman history, but he's also credited with founding the Latin strand of the military writing tradition. So Frontinus gives us Rome. He gives us Mr. Roman right at the start. And then he follows that up immediately with a Carthaginian general from way back in history, not in the Punic Wars, a Carthaginian general attacking Sicily. So that's quite characteristic of the way the text flows. A huge number of the other examples in the text are Carthaginian. Carthage plays a big role, and we see Romans and Carthaginians outwitting each other in quick succession. You know, one Roman success quickly followed by a Carthaginian success. And then lots of Greek and all sorts of other triumphs are thrown in the mix too. Only about half of the exemplar are Roman.
Mm.
But it's also the case that even that Carthaginian example tells us that this treatise ultimately is about the Roman Empire. Because the Carthaginian general we see in the second example is attacking Sicily straight after we've seen an example which involved Cato. Now, Sicily becomes the point at which Rome and Carthage first clash. Rome and Carthage's clashes over Sicily are the start of Rome's interest in an overseas empire and the start of Rome's ongoing conflict with Carthage, which ultimately does end in Carthage's defeat. However much crisscrossing we might do across time and space, this is a treatise that actually gets you thinking about the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm. It also seems that Frontinus is somebody who does the topic justice without giving favouritism to the Romans. Because there would be nothing forcing him to put Carthage examples in here at all, for example. The tactics are good where the tactics are good, no matter what side was deploying them.
Yeah, and in one way, one of the impressions you get from this text is that good generalship is actually a universal phenomenon.
Mm.
Well, it's both a universal phenomenon that's not distinctively Roman or Greek, or, you know, no one nation has a particular prerogative in successful generalship at all. But you also get a sense that good generalship is something that's really quite hard and that it's not actually something that you can learn or be taught. So all the generals we see popping up in this treatise, they're characterised by having cunning or cleverness or wisdom or native intuition. None of them learn generalship by reading a book. And that's a really interesting thing. So one of the things that the text does is kind of make generalship seem both universal, perhaps within our grasp, but also something that's really hard to get right. And, you know, we get this parade of heroes, in a sense, Roman and non-Roman. And it gets you thinking about generalship in different ways. And it gets you kind of breaking out of the nationalistic assumptions and stereotypes. And it gets you thinking about generalship per se, generalship in its kind of pure form, and how hard it is to get right.
Frontinus is somebody that you've said has a military career. So is there any examples of that in here where he's drawn from personal experience?
There are remarkably few in a way. You know, this is a text where Frontinus doesn't intrude his voice very much at all. He doesn't come in and say, now, I think, and this is how generalship should be done. He hardly ever comments on the examples of other generals. Just lets the examples speak for themselves. But two or three times he mentions something as if he has been there and seen it. And there's one really interesting one in particular in the fourth book of the Stratagemeter, nearly at the end of the text. And then you suddenly get this. You get, in the war waged under the auspices of the Emperor Caesar Domitianus Augustus Germanicus, that's Domitian, and begun by Julius Civilis in Gaul, the very wealthy city of the Lingones, which had revolted to Civilis, feared that it would be plundered by the approaching army of Caesar. But when, contrary to expectation, the inhabitants remained unharmed and lost none of their property, they returned to their loyalty and handed over to me 70,000 armed men. Mm. Now that, to me, is the final word in the Latin. Mihi is the final word of the example. It slipped in as this massive surprise. In all of the examples in the treaty start with the general who did them. This is a rare exception, which starts under the auspices of Domitian.
Mm.
I did it. This happened under me. And it's a really fascinating moment in the text, partly because Frontinus is not putting himself forward under an emperor under whom it is dangerous to put yourself forward. He isn't putting himself at the front of that anecdote. He puts himself right at the end. An anecdote that you think is going to be credited to Domitian suddenly, at the last minute, gets credited to him. It is a really interesting anecdote also because at the time that it took place, Domitian wasn't emperor, although he's given all of his imperial titles in this. The generalship lesson that you learn from it is mercy or justice. But it's part of a very tortuous episode in the empire's history. And it's an episode that has its seeds in civil conflict as well, which makes the anecdote particularly interesting.
The last work that we've got from Frontinus that he would have wrote later in his career when he was water commissioner was on the aqueducts in Rome and the watering system. So why was he writing this?
Well, he writes a preface at the start, which explains that he's writing this because he's just been given this very, very important post. He's been made water commissioner and he says he needs to find out everything there is to know about it because it's absolutely disgraceful to be in charge but to be instructed by your assistants. And, you know, if you're in charge, you need to be the directing head and they are the hands and feet who kind of carry out the duties. So one of the reasons why Frontinus is writing this treatise is he says it's to teach himself about his new role. Also, there's a bigger agenda at stake. He is interested in showing that in the new era, Domitian is gone. We've now got Nerva and Trajan, who are restoring a certain amount of responsibility and power to the Senate. Frontinus is interested in showing that when a senator gets given a really important post, he does it really well. He does it very impressively. He's writing a new blueprint almost for senatorial administration. Mm. So he's showing his fellow senators how you do a big public office now in this new era. And you do it by finding out everything, by really being in charge. This is no sinecure. This is a really serious job.
It sounds like he's putting the other senators to shame a bit. He's really taking this job seriously. So what information was he working with when he was writing this? You'd have to go out and learn it and talk to the people who know how the aqueducts are working, wouldn't you?
Well, he clearly had a team of assistants and he must have learned a great deal from them, although they don't feature at all as authorities in his text. There clearly were also records in imperial archives that Frontinus consulted. Now, he spends quite a bit of the treatise telling us how wrong most of these records were and correcting them. So he gets some of his information from records. And, you know, the water system has been administered pretty efficiently, probably.
Yeah.
He doesn't tell that story. Agrippa, under the reign of Augustus, set up a whole new system of administering the aqueduct network. And it's been administered all of that time, and there have been lots of records all of that time. So Frontinus must have consulted them. But it's clear that he also went out on the ground, as an aqueduct commissioner should do, but he did it particularly energetically, and he took lots of new measurements, and he observed and checked and was out on the streets looking at maps, inspecting everything. He claims to have done a huge amount of first-hand research that forms some of the basis of this treatise.
Mm.
By the time Frontinus was writing, there were 9 or 10 aqueducts.
Right, so they're important for delivering clean water to Rome, to cutting down pollution in the city and disease. It was also about separating water sources as well. That's something that he identified in his work, isn't it? That different water should be used for different things.
Yes, I mean, Frontinus actually, interestingly, does make a connection between water cleanliness and he talks about the salubritas, the health of the city. Mm. And he celebrates it. There's a passage fairly in the middle of the treatise, where he celebrates the effects that Nerva's interest and his great efforts in the aqueduct network have had on the health and cleanliness of Rome. And yes, one of the things he identifies is that some aqueducts, which in a rainstorm get very muddy, then come into the city and flow into all the other aqueducts and pollute the whole system. And so one of the innovations that he claims he and Nerva have put in place is actually to separate some of those strands out, and then to say that the aqua marcia is for drinking water only, but the old Anio can be used to kind of clean out the sewers and water people's gardens. He clearly puts a system in place where there's a more rigorous separation. There probably was some separation already, but he kind of institutionalizes the separation of certain sources of water to particular uses.
Mm. What other changes did I identify that needed to be made to the system?
Well, he spends a lot of time talking about mismanagement from the past, which allowed water to leak. Mismanagement because the records were so erroneous that people thought that less water was supposed to be coming out of the system than really could come out of it. And he talks a lot about fraud, about people siphoning off water illegally. And a lot of the treatise is about the ways in which he is combating those problems. He's done all sorts of new measurements. He's got absolutely accurate figures now for how much water each aqueduct should bring to each place in Rome, public fountains, but also the private sources that people have got grants to take individually. He's got a huge amount of data on that now, so no one can pull the wool over his eyes. He also does talk a lot about the laws behind and the processes behind the maintenance of the aqueducts, so making sure that the actual structures are still sound and that people aren't planting trees near them that will mean the roots will grow up and that start kind of causing cracks, or people aren't building monuments too near them that are going to somehow disturb the aqueducts. Mm. So yeah, he and Nerva are cleaning up the system, not just by producing cleaner water, but cleaning out all the corruption and the mismanagement.
So is this the definitive work then on aqueducts? It sounds like this is the final word in it.
Well, I think one of the interesting things is that, yes, Frontinus claims to have written this text to teach himself, but it's clearly written for a much wider audience, an audience, for example, who will notice that he starts by quoting Livy's histories at the very start of the treatise. He says, from the beginnings of the city of Rome. He's writing for a reader who's going to notice literary allusion. He's writing for people who are going to want to turn to this text once and for all, not actually to find out the details of the system. He says at one point, look, you're probably finding this all very dry and complex, so skip forward. Miss out the details, skip to the totals. He's not anticipating readers who are going to read it in full necessarily, but he does expect readers to know about this text as the final statement on how Rome's aqueduct system should function and will function for the future. The final chapter of the text ends with a kind of threat almost. Now I know all of this, although I'd love to be lenient, I'm not going to be lenient. If anyone abuses the system in the future, you're going to get it in the neck. And the emperor's authority is behind me on this. So it's not just a definitive, oh, this is how the aqueducts work. It's a political statement about how the aqueducts are now going to work under Nerva and Trajan. And you've got Frontinus to wrestle with, if you counter that. You know, there's a lot of symbolism. There's a lot of rhetoric in this treatise. And it's a treatise that's actually about the power of Rome. You know, at one point he says, compare the aqueducts with the useless monuments of the Greeks and the idle pyramids. You know, he's celebrating this great Roman institution here.
Mm. He strikes me as somebody who takes his job very seriously. It's an honour to him to be involved in this capacity and to, I suppose, serve the emperor to the best that he can.
Yes, although there is self-interest at work there too. And as I say, Nerva and Trajan are supposed to be returning some big roles and big responsibilities to the Senate. And he's saying, this is what happens when you do. It works, and it works brilliantly. He is staking a big claim on behalf of the senatorial elite in this text. And he ends up sounding and looking quite like the emperor himself. In his preface, he talks about how he is inspired by the same diligence and love for the state as Nerva. And he weaves them both into a kind of image so that they look very, very like each other. And this text is a text that actually gets senators to kind of come really close to the imperial power.
Yeah,
they get to wield imperial power. He's working on behalf of the emperor. He's working in close cooperation with the emperor, and he looks and sounds like the emperor. So this is a far cry from, you know, the previous dynasty where the emperor was a god in comparison to his subjects. Here we've got a kind of an idealized image of a senator working with someone who was actually a fellow senator not so long ago. So it's a text which gets senators, himself in particular, but senators generally, back into the central powerhouse of the Roman imperial administration.
My thanks to my guest today, Dr. Alice Koenig, lecturer in Latin and Classical Studies at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. And you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes. Please leave a review there. We love reviews. And tell your friends about it. Emperors of Rome has a Facebook page, now nearing 3,000 of you lovely people. So go there, give us a like, and tell us what you thought about this episode. You can also follow me on Twitter. I'm at NightlightGuy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, and thank you, you've been waiting patiently, we begin to look at Hadrian. So until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.